I'm going to talk initially about energy and sort of some of these sources of energy, both talking about ones that we call secondary sources and those that we call primary sources, and then as part of the idea of consumption, and then move on to talking about conservation. And at that point, I think it's a great opportunity for us to sort of share ideas of means of conservation. There's some very traditional, well-known means of conservation of energy, but there's also some more subtle ones that people are involved in, which can be very helpful to share. The difference between secondary and primary sources of energy has to do with where the energy is derived from. And in the case of coal, petroleum, gas, and wood, the energy for those has come originally from the sun. And it has been incorporated into plant and animal matter through the process of photosynthesis and growth of a plant, and then has been stored within the earth in some way. And we'll talk a little bit about both coal and petroleum. Wood is one that I think is fairly obvious to us. I mean, the trees, we see them today growing, and we can chop them down, and then we can use them to burn and that heat and light and so on. In the case of coal and petroleum, there's a geologic story that's behind that that makes it a much longer time scale, but it's in fact exactly the same process. On the other hand, when we talk about a primary source of energy, we're talking about one that has no intermediate step, that we're deriving from its original source. And in the case of solar energy, that's the perfect example to complement these, in that we are in fact using the sun's energy directly rather than using energy which was stored by some organism as an intermediary. And the same thing then is true with hydro. Hydro is how all of Holden Village is powered. We're simply taking that energy and harnessing it, which is in falling water. Similarly, tides, wind, and then geothermal is another geologic process, but we're using the heat from the inside of the earth directly for heat, for a source. Now, I'm going to spend a bit of time talking about coal and petroleum formation, some of the implications for uses of those energy, and some of the environmental aspects. Skip just brief and not talk about gas and wood. Gas is a very similar story to petroleum. Wood, I think we're all fairly familiar with that. And I'll skip just briefly through these four, and then spend a bit of time on solar energy, because it's a great lead-in to talking then about energy conservation. There's techniques which are part of very simple applications of solar energy that any of us can use. So, I'm going to start initially by just looking at a little bit about how we consume energy and how it is used in our country versus some other countries as well. If we look at the middle circle in this diagram, it's looking at how energy is used in the United States. And I apologize, stuff is a little cut off on the edge. It won't matter if I get the overhead on there or not. But basically, of the total energy use, and can most of you read the words up here? They are somewhat small, I'm afraid. Of the total energy use, it divides into very close to thirds, into transportation, into buildings, and into industrial use. And then any one of us are dependent upon all parts of this whole pie of energy use. In the case of buildings, we personally can think of it in terms of simply heating or hot water heating or lighting. Those are very direct uses that we make. But on the other hand, most of these industrial applications are also energy types which we are using indirectly. In the case of stone, glass, clay, paper, metals, these are things which have to be processed before we can use them. Metal has to be extracted from the earth, it has to be converted into a pure enough form to then be made into steel for a car or aluminum for a can or so on. And the energy used in that process is an energy that we are, in fact, dependent upon. And similarly, transportation has applications to all of us. This is highway vehicles, air, marine, and rail for this last little bit of the pie here. Now, this is for the United States, and if we were to look at this for other countries, it would have a different shape to this picture, although not dramatically different. If we look at where this energy comes from, in terms of total energy use in the United States, there's a very interesting pattern that we can see if we look at it historically. We're today looking at 1990. But if we look at this energy trend over the last 150 years or so, we can see that initially society in general, although the United States in particular, was dependent upon wood as their primary source of fuel. And so this is in terms of the percentage of the total energy supplied. So we can see here in 1860, close to 90% of it came from wood, and a very small portion of it came from coal. And this very rapidly changed by the turn of the century in 1900, because in part the Industrial Revolution allowed machines to be developed which could harness the energy from coal. And also the exploration of coal had proceeded to the point where we knew of resources to be able to use. And then we can see that coming in just before the turn of the century is then petroleum and natural gas. And this is kind of an interesting story, because I think we all think so much of our society being dependent upon petroleum and natural gas. And yet this crossover really wasn't very long ago. Anyone who spent much time in England may know of the earlier history where prior to World War II, England was dependent primarily on coal, and it had drastic environmental implications. It's interesting to see that this graph then shows nuclear energy increasing, and if we were to look at the pattern which we see here, we might expect that nuclear would have a similar curve, although I think that this projection was made 5 years ago or so, and probably we wouldn't see this increase happening. In fact, there isn't much in the way of new applications of nuclear, but we do see this drop off in petroleum and natural gas, and an interesting increase here in coal, and we'll come back and talk a little bit about that. If we look at the United States in terms of what the present dependence is, and our North America overall, we can see the same kind of thing represented differently, just in terms of percentages of a piece of pie, primarily dependent upon oil, a large amount on coal. Now in that previous diagram, with the curves, gas and oil were linked together, and then nuclear and small amount of hydroelectric. It's interesting to compare this with the rest of the world. And part of this is simply that we have greater supplies of natural gas on this continent. We have easier access to it, we have pipelines that transport it from its source, and so we have a larger sector that's dependent upon natural gas, whereas worldwide more dependence is on coal. One of the last things that's kind of interesting to look at and give us a little bit of a lead into the idea of conservation is to look at sort of the financial status of a country versus what its energy consumption is. So this side of the graph is then showing us energy consumption, and this is showing gross national product. And the United States is here, I've indicated by the red dot, and basically there's a line that fits with a balance sort of between most of the points. But it's kind of interesting to look at the countries which are grouped, which have the same gross national product as the United States, or very similar, and yet their energy consumption is significantly lower. And these countries are Australia, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Japan, Switzerland. And it makes it sort of gives us a little jolt to consider what it is that they're doing differently, and things that we can then think about in terms of our own personal behavior in energy consumption. At this point, are these graphs that people are comfortable with? Do the pie graphs mean something to people? Please consider see these sections. Okay. And don't hesitate to ask questions. I mean, I was sort of going to do this kind of an introduction and then get into more discussion. Yeah?
That one on the world consumption, mm-hmm. getting back to Europe especially, is that all sources of energy?
No,
the one with the pie. The pie.
Well, this is consumption.
Many countries in Europe are like over 50% nuclear.
That's right. This is the world as an average.
Okay.
So that, yes, European countries such as Switzerland, which are highly dependent on hydro, or other countries highly dependent on nuclear, are sort of balanced in there against other countries which have greater dependence on the coal, gas, and oil. Okay, I want to talk both about coal and oil, just to look briefly at the United States in terms of where electricity comes from. it's kind of interesting to contrast what happens in different parts of the country. We can see that in the United States overall, coal is the main source of energy to produce electricity. I think that that is something, if you live in the Northwest, that comes as a bit of a surprise. Because as I've indicated here, the Northwest has a much greater dependence on hydroelectricity. That's not true in the Northeast. Why? What did somebody say? Oh, there's lots of water. What's lacking?
Elevation.
That's right, the relief, the change in the elevation in order to get it. And in the middle part of the country, and we'll come back to this later when we talk about coal, this is where so much of the energy of coal is used. And then in the Northeast, there's a large dependence on gas and oil and also on nuclear energy as well. Interesting, we can see, we'll come back and spend just a bit of time on geothermal, and you can see that's really a very small contribution to the whole thing. So, coal. Where's coal come from? Where today would we be forming something that might be coal in the future?
Swamps.
Swamps, that's right. Has to be swamps that have a lot of productivity to them. The Florida Everglades are always the ones sort of raised as an analog for where we might have a coal swamp. Usually it has to be low enough latitudes that the plants can grow in great abundance year-round. And what we do is then take and bury this plant material, and on a geologic time scale of burial, it will ultimately convert through a sequence of steps to a purer and purer concentration of simply the element carbon. Plants, which we could start as our initial step, are carbon and various other elements which have been incorporated into the tissue through biologic processes. And then as we take and bury this, we end up forcing out some of those other elements. By the time that we come down to anthracite, we have very, very close to 100% coal, 100% carbon. What else isn't 100% carbon?
Diamond.
That's right. And what happens to a diamond if it sits for long enough at the surface? Diamond is formed under extremely high pressures. It's not stable at the surface of the earth. Coal is stable at the surface of the earth.
Diamonds are not forever.
That's right. Very good. So one of the things I've shown here is this idea that per volume of material, we have less carbon in peat, and then as we compress it and bury it through time, we end up with a greater enrichment and higher concentrations of carbon. Well, it is the burning of carbon which gives us energy or produces heat. And so if we have a smaller percentage of carbon in something such as peat, yes, we'll get energy and heat from it, but we'll get much less than if we burn anthracite coal, which is a very high concentration of carbon. But at the same time, there's another change that goes on. Sulfur is another element which is incorporated into organic tissue. And while some of the other elements are forced out, carbon isn't forced out. So while we're concentrating carbon, we're also concentrating sulfur. And we'll come back and talk about this when we talk about some of the environmental implications of it all. Interesting to look at the worldwide distribution of coal in terms of the known reserves of the world, and known is always something that we have to keep in consideration. We can generally expect to find some additional reserves, but geologists tend to feel rather proud that they've found most of the major ones now, and the chances of finding more aren't very good. So, be that what it may, probably this is close to what is there in reality. We can see the United States has very large reserves of coal proportionally worldwide. So does the Soviet Union, China, and then interesting three European countries. And of course, this comes from a source which is more than a year old. We can lump these two together. But we can see that the United States and the Soviet Union account for nearly half of the coal reserves in the world. And yet we saw that in a large proportion of the world is dependent upon coal for a source of energy, which then becomes an interesting balance. Where is the coal in the United States? Coal is primarily in the central portions of the United States. And this map shows us two different things. It shows us in the shaded areas where the coal is. It also shows us what type of coal is found in what portion of the United States? And here in the darker shading is anthracite. Anthracite was then at the bottom of our sequence of alteration of coal. This is where it has the highest carbon concentrations, and along with that, the highest amount of sulfur. In contrast, if we come out here in the Rocky Mountain region, we're then out to where it's subbituminous and lignite. This is just a couple steps past peat. Not as high carbon content and not as high sulfur content. But this does say something about, we're lucky here in this part of the country that we do have so much in the way of hydro energy as a source, because we certainly don't have coal to depend upon out here. And similarly in the Northeast, you can see why they have to be dependent upon oil and natural gas and nuclear. They simply don't have the coal or the hydropower to be able to use. And so when we think about energy uses and distribution, we have to keep in mind that we have very ideal views as to what people should be using as a source of energy, but geography is going to play its part in the whole thing. If we think about the environmental impacts of coal, one thing we can say is that we have a lot of coal. And that sort of puts coal in the plus category. We have a lot of it. We can't say that about all of our resources. And so if we're going to look at one that we want to use as a source of energy, having a lot of it is a good thing. In fact, projections which are made about world coal suggests that even if we look at, back up a sec before I sort of interpret it, this is the amount of production of coal per year. Production, we're talking about how much is dug out of the earth and ready to be used. And this is then time. We can see that as that earlier graph showed, the production of coal, the use of coal increased during the 20th century. And even though the dependence on coal has diminished, still the production is increasing because the population of the world has increased. And what scientists have done is to look at both a high estimate of how much coal is out there and a low estimate of how much coal is out there and predict how long that will be around to be available to us. Two different things we can look at in these curves, where the peak in production is based on these two estimates. And in either case, it's a long time in our lifetimes to the peak of production. Even with the small estimates, we're looking at a peak in production in the year 2100. With the high estimates, we're looking at a peak in production in the year 2200. That means that in terms of the next century, we don't have to be quite as concerned about the conservation of coal as we'll see that we do when we look at oil. The other thing we can look at is when most of this production is used up. With the low estimates, we're looking at most of it being used up in terms of the area under the graph by sometime between 22 and 2300. Looking at the high estimates, 24 to 2500. So a lot of coal out there. That's good. That means that's not one of the considerations that we have to think about. The other thing is we know where these deposits of coal are. That makes them fairly accessible. The mining of coal, the extraction of coal, is a fairly easy process. It isn't a very pretty process if anybody's ever traveled in coal mining areas. I mean, it's pretty devastating to the surface of the earth, even though the government thinks they're regulating what you have to do to those mines after the coal's been extracted. And the technology for removing that coal is pretty well developed as well. Mining technology has been around for a long time. We know how to get in and get out, get the coal out, with a fairly minimum expense. But the problems of coal are also very large. And the one is this idea of the concentrations of sulfur in the coal. And that's something that I will be talking about later on in the week. But what is it that sulfur is doing that's so bad? Acid rain, that's right. As we burn coal, we're putting carbon dioxide up in the atmosphere. That has some negative consequences. But we're also putting sulfur dioxide up in the atmosphere. And when that sulfur mixes with water in the atmosphere, that's when we're producing sulfuric acid, which then comes back to the earth as acid rain. The whole process of using coal requires vast amounts of water in the cooling process and in the process of making steam from the heating process to then drive turbines to to generate electricity, and that water is often altered in the process, if only by being heated. We don't think of heating water as necessarily bad, but if we're using large volumes of water and heating it and returning it to the environment that we extracted it from, then we're changing something about that system that we took that water from. Now, I have a good story about that. I know of an oil burning power plant in Maine where they enlarged it, increased its volume about 4 times to produce more power. It changed the temperature of the whole bay by about a degree or two, and the lobster population flourished. So if you happen to be a lobsterman or if you happen to like lobster, that was good. But it's disturbing the ecosystem. It's disturbing the balance between all the different organisms. And that's a part of energy production that we don't see very often. We just know that the energy gets produced. Maybe the power plant's ugly. Maybe there's a lot of trucks or tankers coming in. But heating the water is not good for the environment either. And then, as I referred to, the extraction of coal from the earth is not a pretty process. Whether it be strip mines or subsurface mines, we have to deal with, as we're reminded here, whatever came out of that mine that we didn't want in the form of spoil piles. In open pit mining, we're left with open pits. In subsurface mining, we're left with usually quite soft and unstable rock, and so there's the fear of collapse and things like that. So it's a real toss-up in terms of coal. We have a lot of it, but it's really ugly to extract it and to burn it
What about safety to people that extract coal and technology? That's what I've done.
Coal is not a pretty substance to mine. It's very soft. The mining here was done in incredibly hard rock, and those mine shafts and tunnels will probably survive for hundreds of years without any problem. And there were very few fatalities in this mine, usually due to human error, because the material that they were mining in was so stable that they didn't have to worry about the fear of collapse. Coal is usually in very soft rock, and so that's a real problem. Coal is also really dirty rock, and you're down in there breathing the dust from it, and there's all sorts of health hazards from that as well. Is that the kind of thing you were...
Yeah, that's it.
Now, we can contrast this with petroleum. And petroleum has a lot more complicated story in terms of accessing it than coal. In coal, all we had to do was take plant matter, bury it for a long time, and we ended up with coal, and then we go and we dig it out once we know where it is. Oil has more steps. Oil in the same way comes from usually plant material, which has been buried. It doesn't just have to be compressed, though, in the way coal does. It has to be heated to a very specific temperature, in terms of the sort of geologic story behind it. And if it's heated too much, then it's turned into natural gas. If it's not heated enough, it's just kind of sludge, and it never quite makes it all the way to oil. So there's a much narrower frame in terms of which we're producing oil in the subsurface. As you can see from coal, there are lots of steps. There are countries that burn peat for source of energy. There are countries that also can burn anthracite. So we have to bury it, and for a long time, geologically. Not anything that can be renewed on our time scales. Much longer time. It has to be heated to a very fine temperature, not too hot, not too cold. And then it's usually disseminated throughout many, many layers of rock. And in order for it to be of any use to us to extract, it has to do something called migrate. And this is just a little sketch that shows this idea. Usually it was produced in some rock. This symbol here means something like shale or clay, very fine-grained rock, but you can't extract it from that without taking all of the rock out. What you want to be able to do is simply drill an oil well down and just pull out the liquid. Well, it usually then migrates because oil is lighter than the surrounding rock, and then it has to be trapped somewhere. And so it has to have some fine bed above it. And this whole process has to be heated in order to produce the oil, and then it has to migrate and be trapped in some location to make it a large enough reservoir to be worth going in after. How long does this take? Tens of millions of years, minimum. Who knows where the first oil well was drilled?
Pennsylvania.
First oil well in this country was in fact in Pennsylvania, that's right. First oil well drilled was in Romania in 1857. When was the first oil well drilled in this country? 1859. How long had that resource been being tapped? In that one location in Pennsylvania, in Titusville, Pennsylvania. It comes from a place called Oil Creek. The Indians had been using it to seal their canoes. Because the oil, in fact, seeped out at the surface there. But the first time they drilled down to where it was seeping from was in 1859. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? I mean, our society is so dependent upon oil, and yet we're only looking at a resource that was really first tapped a little over 100 years ago. Reserves, where are most of the reserves in the world? And boy, does this kind of a diagram bring it home. Now, this is in terms of reserves in billions of barrels. This isn't done in terms of percentages. But converted to percentages, within the in Saudi Arabia and the Arabian Peninsula, we're looking at close to 40% combining both. No, I can't remember what my numbers combined. So Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and I don't remember if I combined both Iraq and Iran with that. But it does become a bit obvious why, despite the government's denial, that we were interested in getting involved in that war a year ago. I mean, there's a huge proportion of oil which is over there, and if we're dependent upon oil, we hardly even show up on this diagram. Just this very small amount. The U.S. has about 4% of the known reserves, Mexico about 6%. Soviet Union somewhere about 9%. So the reserves aren't where we are. In our country, there are reserves, there are known reserves, there are a few unknown reserves as well. Possibly, but for the most part, we probably have a pretty good fix on where they are. This shows one that we're fairly familiar with there in the Gulf of Mexico. Lots of extraction, and up through the area of Texas, Oklahoma, Nebraska, a lot of extraction of oil there. This is also showing us Alaska extraction here on the North Slope. Some of the other areas here off the coast of California, where there's also been a lot of extraction of oil. Not much where we live. Another good reason that we're lucky to have hydropower here. And yet, this is an area where they believe there are some known reserves that have not really been tapped at this point. Well, the question then comes, okay, so we know where the reserves are. How do we get the oil out? The coal would just go dig a hole and pull it out, right? How do we go get oil out? It isn't exposed to the surface for the most part. Titusville, they were lucky. Well, you have to hire geologists who think they know where it is. And there's all sorts of techniques, primarily geophysical techniques, to go and study the subsurface. Sometimes you drill holes to know something about the geology, but most of the time, you're standing up on the surface and you're using techniques called remote sensing techniques, just as if you were studying a planet. And you're something a long way away and you think you know that it'll give you this kind of a signal with this kind of material. And then after you do that, you say, okay, let's go drill a hole there and see if there's oil there. How many holes do you have to drill on average to find one that really has oil? Even after you are in an area where you think there's oil.
Five.
Ha. 150. One out of 150 oil wells produces oil. And that's when we've already gone to an area where we think that we know that there's oil. And then you got to get it out of the ground. But it costs about $5 million to drill an oil well. So how much does an oil well have to produce when you get it out of the ground in order to pay for all the other ones? Right? So you got to have an oil well that produces $750 million worth of oil in order to make it worth all the 149 other ones that you drilled to find the one that was successful. Got to get it out of the ground. That's not an easy process. When the oil is pressured, it'll come up to the surface easily, but after you've depleted that resource, then you have to start pumping something else down in there to bring the oil up. That often means you're pumping water in to bring the oil up. and then the oil's not as pure, and so you have to go through some processing. We always have to process oil, we always have to refine it to whatever quality of oil, excuse me, we're interested in. Sometimes that includes taking the water out of it as well. Then what do we have to do? Well, then we have to take it someplace, we'll take it to the refinery, take it away from the refinery, and then sometimes it's made available for purchase and use. Do you have a guess as to how long it takes between the first time we extract it and when we can say it ends? And remember when I showed the diagram that showed this idea of the oil migrating up to a reservoir, we could have taken that rock that it was that it originally formed in. Then we have to take all the rock out, and grind it up, and heat it enough to sort of make the oil flow out of it. And then once again, we're left with huge volumes of material that are waste rock, just as the tailings are here. Generally, you only get 100 liters of oil per ton of rock. That's at the best. That's a lot of waste rock that you have to deal with in that whole process. And so there's a lot of talk, particularly in the Rocky Mountain region, of going after oil shales. But oil shales environmentally are going to be a real mess. We don't have to go drill an oil well for it, but we're going to have to dig up huge sizes of mountains to get it out. On the other hand, there's a suggestion that we could get somewhere between 50 and 75 years of oil out of those rocks. So that'll be a real battle. In terms of the environmental impacts of oil, if we do in fact find a successful well, then we have one oil rig and we don't have to have one for miles. Unlike coal, where we're destroying vast areas of the surface, that has a very small area impact. Obviously it's not too pleasant to look at. How many people here have driven through an area down here in the Four Corners? Or through the Los Angeles basin, what do you see? See these pumps going like this all the time? There's one here in this area which is called the James Watt National Forest, where it's just all you can see is oil rigs just pumping away like this. Need to say it doesn't have that name officially. But most of the time, if you have a great big one, you don't have to have a lot of other ones. On the other hand, some of the areas that we started to tap most recently, it has devastating impacts to even have one oil well. In particular up here, we're dealing with a vegetation which is just incredibly sensitive to any weight or pressure on it. And remember, we had to go drill 149 wells before we found one that produced. So we had a lot of equipment running around in there to find that one successful hole. And the impact there is very drastic, both to the vegetation itself, and then the instability of that ground surface on that vegetation is such that it makes the oil lines very susceptible to rupture and things like that. One of the real questions that comes out is, how long is the oil going to last? And in the same way that was done for coal, projections have been made about the oil reserves as well. And remember, our graph for the coal showed us that maximum production wasn't going to be for somewhere another 100 or 200 years. The same person did estimates, and I wasn't able to Xerox the graph, so I sketched it for you. The same person did estimates about the reserves of petroleum, and we can see that we don't have anywhere near the same time frame. We have high estimates, we have low estimates. With our low estimates, we reach a maximum in production of oil in the processing of known reserves in 1990. With the high estimate, we reach a maximum of production in 2000. Okay, so that still gives us a few years. We have all the rest of this to produce. But even if we look at when we will have consumed 80% of all the known reserves, we're looking at somewhere between the year 2020 and the year 2030. That is a very pleasant projection of the whole process. Obviously, coal's going to last us a lot longer globally than oil is. And we already can see some of this showing up. U.S. oil production has been declining over the last decade. Our reliance on imports has been skyrocketing as our reserves are being used up. But globally, the projection is that we're even going to be using up the worldwide reserves as well. Okay, that is, at this point, that ends what I want to talk about these two, what we call secondary sources, the oil and coal, and now I want to talk just a bit about primary reserves, primary sources, unless anybody had any questions about this. Hydropower is great if you can have the right situation to produce it. Supplies only about 5% of the world's energy, although a larger percentage of the world's electricity overall. Very efficient for electricity. Interesting things. You can vary the amount of electricity produced in a day in hydro, simply by sort of how wide you open your gates to let the water go through. That's real hard to do with coal and oil. And so in the Northwest, we're very lucky. We can increase the amount of electricity produced during peak hours and diminish it during the lesser hours. It doesn't produce much in the way of pollution. We're not burning anything up, not releasing anything out to the atmosphere. But what is the devastating impact of hydropower? Well, we're doing something to rivers. And we're changing the natural course of the river, and generally that has a lot of impact on the organisms that live there. Anybody who's ever been to any of the hydro dams out here, you often see lots of fish ladders. That's something you need, since we have fish who depend on going upstream. Put a dam there, they can't get there by themselves. Some other problems that aren't quite as apparent is that we build a dam and it traps things behind it. It traps sediment behind it. In the normal course of a flow of a river, that sediment is transported out to the coastline and becomes part of the beaches. What do we do if we trap the sand? It doesn't get to the beaches. What happens to our beaches? They erode. How many people here have ever been to Southern California? You used to have big, beautiful, wide beaches. Every river in Southern California is dammed. And the beaches are just eroding inwards constantly because we don't have that source of sand out to the beaches. Tidal energy is one which is great idea, but only usable in very, very unique circumstances where the tide can flow into a very narrow channel, have a very hot, large range of change in the course of the day, and it's harnessed in a similar fashion to the way locks work on a river. You trap the water behind it, and then you let the water drop down. Once the tides have dropped, you let the water run down very rapidly. There's a few places where there's potential for this. The Rance River in France, it is being used at the present time. Bay of Fundy in Canada is another possible place. Cook Inlet in Alaska is one of the few places in the United States. That doesn't help much of the rest of the country. Again, tidals not having enormous impact in terms of pollution, but it certainly is going to disrupt the ecology in the same way that dams and rivers do. Wind. How many here have ever seen wind farms for electricity? What's the problem with a wind farm?
Noise.
Noise, that's right. It isn't exactly pretty either. What do you have? You have all these windmills, but you have to have a very unique set of circumstances. The wind has to blow strong enough to turn those windmills, but it can't blow too hard or else you'll break them. It's just a few places. Southern California, east of northern L.A., the mountains area, huh?
Tehachapi Pass.
Right, and they're everywhere as you drive through that pass. But there's not a lot of places where the situation is just perfect for wind power. So one of the things that this points out is that, like our hydropower in the Northwest, there are certain areas which have the ability to develop an alternative source of power, and maybe those areas should be pushed for it, but it can't be done everywhere. Certainly, windmills have been going for a very long time in terms of a source of energy, and that needs to continue. Now, geothermal energy is something which is very interesting. There are certain countries in this world which can produce a lot of energy from geothermal resources. And what we mean is some source of heat from the interior of the Earth which is making its way close enough to the surface to be tapped as a source of heat. And for the most part, this doesn't happen. If you've ever been to places where there's hot springs, that's in fact what's happening, is there's heat making its way very close to the surface. And there's a couple of countries which are extremely dependent upon geothermal energy. Italy has a very good source of geothermal energy in the northern regions. It's tapped quite efficiently. Iceland is almost entirely dependent upon geothermal energy. New Zealand is in large part dependent upon geothermal energy. But if we look in the United States, it's not something that we can use throughout the entire country. Now, it kind of is the opposite of coal. That's not a bad idea. This is where scientists believe there is a potential for geothermal resources. Extracting geothermal resources is not a very simple thing to do. The geysers area in California is one where actually was first tapped as a source to produce electricity in 1959. And it was predicted that by the year 2000, it would produce 25% of California's electricity. You use that heat to produce steam in water, steam will turn turbines, and you produce electricity. Well, guess what? What's the problem with geothermal energy? It doesn't last. It's a transient kind of geologic source. They are now down to producing 6% of California's electricity. Basically, the steam pressure within the earth is simply vanishing, so that they do not have the ability to produce as much electricity as they originally thought. The comment is, so there are too many straws, too many wells drilled, too many straws in a teapot to make efficient use of it. So here, California thought they had this great resource, and unfortunately, it's basically running dry. No pollution again from geothermal resources, and yet they have very limited lifetime. Suggestion is maybe a maximum of 200 years, which is a few lifetimes, but it certainly isn't a long-term one we can depend upon. It's also extremely corrosive. Very high concentrations of minerals, which show up in the water and steam, come out in geothermal regions, plugs up the pipes, plugs up the plumbing systems, and often it sort of dissolves whatever is there as well. So the last one of the types of primary sources that I wanted to talk about was solar. And as I said, this kind of gives us a step into then talking about conservation practices. Within the United States, it's estimated that somewhere on the order of 20% of the residential and industrial buildings use some form of solar power in the United States. And I think that probably comes as a surprise to most of us. I don't think there's too many of us here who have solar panels on our roofs or things like that. There was great hope in the later part of the 70s that that would become a very accessible source of heating, primarily water both and space heating, in homes. But it turned out to be very expensive to do, and so it isn't very common. We'd love to see it more common. But solar really has two different ways in which it can be in use. One is what we think of as active solar systems, and that's solar panels and pumps and things like that, or even the production of electricity using solar power. Does anybody know a very common place that electricity is produced using solar power? Highway signs. Okay, but in this country, highway signs. Emergency phone boxes. You drive, particularly in California where it's sunnier a larger proportion of the year than it is in the Northwest. You drive up the highway signs, and when you see big tall poles over these emergency phones and little solar panels above them. Or the signs overhead on highways, there will be solar panels above them. And that's producing enough electricity to then heat, to then light those in the off hours. But there's a lot of means to passively use solar power. And it's a good guess that a large proportion of us are doing it. Some of us know we're doing it, and others of us just happen to be lucky. One of the best examples of an old, ancient community that made use of solar power were the Anasazianians. Who knows where they lived? They were the cliff dwellers. Where did they live? Now down in the Four Corners area, oops, I don't have that map up here anymore, but down in this region here, they lived in cliffs. Which way did their homes face?
South.
South.
Huh? They're building to the north walls.
That's right. They're building canyons on the north walls facing south. Well, what was it that they did that was so creative in the use of solar energy? What happens in the course of the year to the elevation of the sun? That's right. It's higher in the summer months, right? And lower in the winter months. Well, if you have a home which is built facing south, and you have an overhang, as the Anasazi Indians did in terms of the cliffs above them, then in the summer months, your overhang is going to block out most of the direct sun. And so whatever is built beneath that overhang will stay cooler. And in the winter months, when the sun is lower, then you'll have more direct rays coming in and actually heating into that area. And so older homes that were built with large overhangs are, in a very simple fashion, taking advantage of this idea of the passive solar energy. The large overhangs are protecting direct sun in the warmest months of the year and letting it come in the cooler months of the year. What's another way that you can do a similar kind of thing without having an overhang? What can you do on this side of a house? That's right. You plant your deciduous tree here, and what does that do? In the summer months, it gives you some sort of a blocking of the sunlight, right? And in the winter months, when the leaves have fallen off, then the sun can shine directly onto that wall or onto that surface. So in fact, to surround a house by that, or to provide shade over a home, is a wonderful way with deciduous trees, because then in the winter months you can take advantage of that heat coming down. Some of the other things which the Anasazi Indians were doing was that they had their walls built of a combination of stone and a mortar of basically adobe to hold that together. Great material to build walls from. It's thick, it's insulating in the cold months, it's insulating in the warm months. It keeps the heat out because it's hard for it to penetrate and absorb through all that thickness of rock. This is a great example. This is a drawing that's actually showing some more sophisticated ways to make use of solar energy. These walls here are then emulating this idea of adobe. A very simple way to do this. There's a community here in Davis, California. Has anybody here ever been to Davis, California? There is an area there in Davis where all of the homes in this one community must use solar energy. It's a fascinating area to travel around. The homes are all unique design. Everybody has had some sort of consulting. There are sod homes where they're simply there under the surface, and in the same way the earth is a very good insulator. There are a lot of homes which simply have large columns filled with water. Water changes its temperature very slowly. It heats up, absorbs the heat from the surrounding area, and stores that heat, and then can re-radiate that heat when the day cools off. And so a simple kind of a heat absorbent wall is something filled with water, or just even columns filled with water. Obviously good insulation, airspaces, things like that act as good insulators as well. In terms of the rest of the time, to talk about conservation, I'm sure that all of us have ideas, and I can sit here and throw out a whole bunch of ideas, or you all can talk about some of the different ways in which you know of to conserve energy. The first category I thought we could start with is simply that of transportation, and there's very complicated ways to conserve energy, and there's very simple ways to conserve energy. How can you save 100% of the energy? Yeah, that's right. Walk, or you can bicycle. How can you save half of the energy? Carpool or public transportation. All kinds of public transportation. Car, where is that number? A car generally burns a gallon of gasoline in 10 minutes. Anybody know how long it takes a jet to burn a gallon of gasoline? 1/10 of a second. So if you're going to ride public transportation, you should probably stick to bus or rail.
That's right.
What other things can you do, slightly more sophisticated, to increase your own energy efficiency in transportation of an automobile? Drive, that's right, 50-55. Most cars, that's their maximum efficiency. Huh?
Buy
a fuel efficient car, that's right. That's the simple beginning step, yeah?
Right.
What else? Once you've got a car, what can you do to enhance its efficiency?
Keep it tuned up.
Keep it tuned up. What else?
Inflate the tires.
That's right. Keep the tires at the proper inflation. You can waste an enormous amount of gasoline by having tires at the wrong inflation. other things, acceleration and deceleration at steady speeds rather than abruptly. You tell that to a 16 or 17 year old and they won't care. But in fact, that is very useful. Maintaining a steady speed once you're going at a speed. They're real simple things, and yet I don't know that, I think the group here that I interact with, I feel that people think about these things, but one of the most important things that's going to happen in the next few decades is figuring some means to convey this information. And I'm always glad to see young members of the audience, because that information is going to reach them younger than it reached an awful lot of us. When I learned to drive in the early 1970s, we had this think about oil consumption then, but not in the same way that we're going to in a couple more decades. Okay, in our homes, there's a whole bunch of different ways to conserve, in sort of different categories of energy conservation. In terms of lighting, what can you do to save energy?
Shut off the lights.
That's right. Turn them off when you leave the room, right? How many people do that conscientiously? I don't do it quite as conscientiously as my husband, and he does it every time I walk out of the room, and I'll stand there saying, but I was just about to go back in, but... What other things can you do to save energy?
Fluorescence.
Fluorescent lights. Three times as efficient as incandescent lights, and three times as ugly, right? I mean, the light is not as pleasant from a fluorescent light, although it's improving the quality of it. What else can you do?
Insulate.
For light?
Insulate. Well, for light.
For light. We're still talking about light. We'll come to that. We'll come to heat in just a sec. What else can you do for light? Yeah. Hang on. We're still on light. A dimmer switch, right? Just a dimmer switch. That'll change the amount of light that you use depending upon how much light is needed. Use natural light. One of the saddest things that happened during the 70s and 80s was this tendency for public buildings to have windows that diminished in size. That then has increased the dependence upon artificial lighting inside. Natural lighting is a great form of lighting, and it's real sad not to be able to use it. Okay, people want to talk about other things. Heating, all sorts of kinds of things that we can do. How can we save energy in heating?
Insulate.
That's real critical. I'm a real sinner in that respect because our house was built before insulation. We can turn the thermostat down, right? I think a lot of us were made conscious of that in the 1970s with the crunch that took place. Then my mother always tells the story of when they first moved to their home in the 1950s, she spent the winter running around in short sleeve shirts. You know, she went outdoors and she bundled up, but inside she wanted to wear a short sleeve shirt. That changed a lot in the 1970s, didn't it? Carter made it very popular to wear a sweater during the day in the cold months. And that really is a very important thing to do, and I think that has changed a lot, but it still amazes me how many people want to dress in lighter weight clothes. And in fact, it's very distressing to be in a workplace where they've got the heat cranked up. I think a lot of people have gotten very accustomed to it. What else can you do to increase the efficiency in your own home? Besides insulation, double pane windows. Can't afford that, just plastic on a window gives you this trapped air in the middle to act as insulation. Making sure that windows are caulked around them so that there aren't cracks that leak. Weather stripping on doors. You can save pennies here and there, and it can really add up in terms of the whole thing. How can you help better distribute the heat in the home? Okay. That's right. Close off areas that you don't want to heat so that you're not wasting the heat.
We just got a brand new furnace, and he said, do not do that. He said, it's going to work far more efficiently if you open the doors because it was geared to fit the size of the house.
And he was assuming you were using the entire house all the
time. No, he said even those rooms that we do not
use. No, but I'm saying that it was installed probably to fit the size of the house overall. And yet, if you had bought a furnace to fit half the size of the house and then closed half of it off, but that is probably true of certain furnaces.
And it certainly is more efficient in terms of the amount of oil it burns.
But that same furnace was so much more efficient than our old one.
That's right.
To get the gas.
That's right.
Way down.
That's right. Now, did you go from oil to gas in that?
Oil. We got oil.
Oil to oil, just a more efficient one. Fans. We all think of fans in the summer months, but fans are very useful in the winter months to distribute heat. Where does heat go in a room? It doesn't really help all the rest of us, right? Having a furnace cleaned and tuned, I mean, we think of that in our cars, but furnaces need that too. That keeps the efficiency up. Having window coverings so that you don't lose heat out through those areas. And then some of what we've talked about in terms of the solar system, the solar use of energy. I mean, having windows that we can actually bring heat in during the warm parts of the day and things like that. A couple of things that I think are more subtle. Exhaust fans in bathrooms and kitchens. What are they doing? They're taking air. And what are they doing with it? Putting it outside. So you're really heating the outdoors in the cold months of the year. And so to reduce the use of those fans, even a small amount is going to help in terms of that efficiency. Something that I hadn't ever really thought of, I'm sure our grandparents and our great-grandparents and generations before knew this, but we just sort of had lost track of it, is that after you finish taking a bath, if you leave the water in the tub, you can heat a small house for about an hour from the heat of that water in the tub. And as I say, generations ago, I'm sure they knew that for a fact. But we all, I mean, we just open it immediately, right? You don't want to let the rain grow around the tub, yeah.
Another thing to do if you have a dryer, a gas dryer, or any dryer, duct it under the house rather than to the outside.
That's
or have a valve that you can...
It's a really interesting issue, isn't it? The amount of energy that goes out through a wall that
but
comes
that
from a dryer.
That doesn't work in certain climates. You try that.
No, the problem...
It's a human climate.
That's right. The problem is the humidity, and we've
you
talked about that.
Your whole house.
That's right. It's a real problem with humidity, and you wish there were some way to somehow extract the humidity from that air so that it really could then be useful air again. Because it's basically taking air from the inside and putting it outside too. Yeah.
Take your dryer to the dump and use a
clothesline. Right. One of my next issues that I was going to raise was simply in terms of appliances. And this is a book which the bookstore here has. And it's a really great little book. It deals with all kinds of different ways to protect the earth. And basically what it does is it starts with a challenge, the garbage mess, hazardous waste, saving water, water pollution, and it spends a little bit of time talking about what the problem is of that issue. And then it addresses different means to improve the situation for that issue. And one of the paragraphs that it has is great. It talks about how, okay, there are big appliances which we've all become dependent upon. Hot water heaters, refrigerators, and things that we really in this day and age, can't live without very easily. But there's an awful lot of appliances that we've all, that have come out on the market. Do you really need an electric toothbrush? Do you really need an electric knife sharpener? Do you really need an electric can opener? And those, there's just a penny here and there, but, you know, the old adage, a penny saved. And this idea of line drying clothes. Here, how many people put their clothes in the dryer? I have been putting my clothes in the dryer because I can never find a dryer to use. They're always all full. But have you tried drying your clothes here outside on the clothesline?
Are they on?
Yes. And it takes an hour. I mean, they're dry like that. It is so dry here that you wait an hour just to get a dryer and your clothes could have been dry outside. It's really quite amazing. But of course they're not as soft as if you run them in a dryer. Some dryers nowadays have cycles without heating, so that's more efficient. How about in a dishwasher, what can you do to save energy?
Open the windows.
That's right. Don't run it through the dry cycle, turn it off before the dry cycle, or disconnect the dry cycle. Either open it up or leave it closed, but it doesn't need to be heated to dry. There's already a lot of stored heat in there. In terms of loads of laundry, run a full load, don't run a half load. It's almost the same amount of energy going into it. A lot of signs around here reminding us about things like shorter showers. And here we have all the energy we need in these months, don't we? And yet it still is worth thinking about